This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We're going to talk politics today. We'll contrast an important trend in America with one in Europe. Both of these show us the direction these world powers are taking, and they both align with Bible prophecy in some powerful ways. In America, the process of preparing for the next presidential election is already beginning. We're always in an election cycle in this country. And as Democrats are announcing their intentions to run against President Donald Trump, they're putting forward some amazingly radical policies on which they intend to run. We'll talk to Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the dramatic political shift left these candidates are taking. Meanwhile, in Europe, a different but equally radical political trend is unfolding, the rise of new parties that are challenging the status quo in several countries. The press is calling these populist movements Eurosceptic. They say they're threatening the future of the European Union, but we'll talk with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about a different direction this trend might take. In some ways, what's happening in America and in the European Union are mirror images of each other, likely to take these powers in very different directions. After that, we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Anthony Chibodwe about his native Zimbabwe and some serious protests taking place there over recent moves by the government. We'll talk about what the ultimate solution to the people's suffering there will be. And I'll conclude today's show by talking about why a husband needs to put on wife-colored glasses from time to time. We'll start, though, with this trend in America. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
So we've been seeing some Democratic presidential candidates launching their campaigns in recent days. Why don't you start by giving a brief overview of the trend that we've been seeing, and then we can start talking about some of the specific candidates.
Right, because as you mentioned before, as the nation as a whole is definitely shifting dramatically to the left. It's kind of interesting to see. A lot of people were curious which direction the Democratic Party was going to go after their defeat the last election cycle.
Right.
President Donald Trump, the Republican candidate last election cycle, at least on economic matters, shifted a little bit to the left compared to the traditional Reagan-style Republican on issues like free trade and government infrastructure projects. He's been a more of a centrist. And so people were wondering if the Democratic Party was going to shift a little more towards the center too and try to compete with the Republicans for those, I guess, more moderate voters, but have, by all indications, seem to decide to take the exact opposite approach and have a whole roster of new candidates who are even coming into the left of former President Barack Obama, shifting harder to the left in their strategy to take back power.
Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and get into some of the specific candidates and some of their policy, some of the platforms that they're promoting here.
Right, because currently the biggest name or most high-profile candidate is Senator Elizabeth Warren. And surprisingly, she's a little unique in this field of lineup is that she's not a self-avowed socialist. She does not say she espouses socialism. She says she's a capitalist, but she wants to fix capitalism, not replace it.
Mm-hmm.
That's her rhetoric. In her proposals, she may be the most socialist candidate running at all, even more so than Bernie Sanders by some measures.
Well, I remember us talking about, I guess it was this last summer, that she was talking about essentially making any business over a certain size a public business.
Right. Last August, she didn't pass, but she proposed a bill to the Senate called the Accountable Capitalism Act. And this is supposed to be accountable capitalism. It goes along with her MO of trying to have like a good, friendly capitalism. But the bill itself, basically, when you look at the details of it, wants government supervision and government management of any business that makes more than $1 billion. And I mean, the average American hears that like, oh, $1 billion sounds like a lot of money. But when you crunch the numbers, and I took like a full day combing through boring spreadsheets to try to crunch those numbers, 90 by sales volume, 90% of America's economy comes from businesses. 90% of America's sales come from businesses that generate more than $1 billion in revenue. Right. So you're basically counting like the largest seizure of wealth in human history, where the government takes control of 90% of the private sector. And then when you combine that with the fact of the public sector, the part of the economy the government already controls, basically the government would run 97% of the entire U.S. economy. Mm. Which would be not as bad as Joseph Stalin, but worse than Vladimir Lenin. I think Vladimir Lenin only nationalized 95% of the Soviet economy before Joseph Stalin took over the remaining 5%.
But she's not a socialist. She's a capitalist.
No, but yeah, she's not. She wants friendly capitalism. And, Mr. Stephen Fleury had on his Trumpet Daily program this morning as well another proposal she had about taxing the assets, all individual assets over $50 million. So basically, like if any individual has not $50 million in income, but $50 million in assets, that gets taxed 2%, and that would be year by year. So it's not, that's the difference. Is income, you it's taxed once when you earn it.
Right.
Assets, you, is this what you own?
Yeah.
And so like every year you can take 2% of everything you own.
That's amazing.
And so, yeah, that's
so
another.
It's never beyond the reach of the government.
It's never beyond to every year if you've got a.
And she was even talking about anything that you own anywhere in the world. You can't funnel it away somewhere and.
Right, you put it in there. So yeah, you've got I don't know. You've got some millionaire with $100 million or $50 million yacht parked in the Cayman Islands or something like that.
Yeah.
Even though you bought that yacht with money you paid taxes on,
right?
The yacht still has a value of $50 million, and so it's taxed 2% every year.
Yeah. So she's clearly making a play for the people that are out there who just feel like the rich should be paying more. Like I should be getting more money from rich people. They have more than they need, and I don't have as much as I need. So
right, yeah, which seems to be the common thread across the lineup. Another big name they've got is California Senator Kamala Harris.
Mm-hmm.
I guess she just announced her candidacy in front of Oakland City Hall, in front of a group of 20,000 people.
Right.
Which they're calling her the female Barack Obama. And they actually said when Barack Obama has announced his candidacy, he only got a crowd of 15,000.
Mm-hmm.
So she's already made a bigger splash than he did on his debut. And she's, I guess, another one similar to Warren is that she says, I'm a centrist independent running outside the two-party system. So she's trying to say, it's like, I'm not conservative, not liberal. I'm right in the middle. And yet her proposal, she's basically co-opted Senator Bernie Sanders' proposals from the last election. She's calling for debt-free college for everyone, free Medicare for all, basically free health care for everyone. I think George Mason University crunched the numbers on that free Medicare for all proposal and figured out it's going to cost the government $3.26 trillion every year, which is 95% of all current tax revenue.
Wow.
And so basically every 95% of all tax revenue now is going to pay for this free healthcare program. Kamala Harris and Bernie Sanders are have proposed.
Yeah.
And I guess they're either going to have to drastically increase taxes or just print money or print or borrow money into oblivion to pay for everything else the government does.
Right. Yeah. So who else have we got?
Senator Kristen Gillibrand. She's the third big name senator who's running, who's got quite the rigmarole of radical beliefs. She's definitely embraced legal marijuana. She's embraced the call to abolish the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, the Border Control Agency. Mm-hmm. She's also calling for a guaranteed government jobs program for all Americans. Any American who wants a job or who got
right.
fired from their job can just go to the government and ask for one, and there's like legally guaranteed that they have to get one.
Now, this is a fairly radical proposal that it's been around for a little bit for a while, but to see that in a major political candidate, this is a first.
Right. Senator Bernie Sanders didn't call for that last election, but he's definitely calling for it now.
Hmm.
Kristen Gillibrand is not the only Democratic candidate who's calling for that program. She's the only Democratic candidate I've actually got information in front of me on for that program. But it's just interesting. I was just thinking about it. It's like when you put those three things together, she's like, well, abolish the immigration agency, legalize marijuana, and guarantee everyone a free job, which basically means like anyone in Latin America could come here for cheap drugs and a guaranteed income.
Mm. Well, they definitely are courting the immigration vote.
Right, right. That's I've heard that said before, is that sometimes you get libertarians will call for open borders occasionally, but they're also very against government benefits. And then socialists are very for government benefits, but in other nations are sometimes against open borders. They said those two proposals are a bad combination. You're like,
right.
We want open borders and government benefits. And I'm like, well, who's going to pay for it? Like, anyone in the world can just come here and demand free stuff.
Right.
They said if you're in the few nations like Scandinavia that actually have some socialist programs that haven't destroyed their countries yet, they're pretty strict on immigration because they have to know that, like, all right, well, we're taxing our people 60-70% to pay for all these government benefits, so we want to make sure that our people get those government benefits.
Right.
We can't just open the border for anyone from Africa, Asia, or Latin America to just come here and start claiming free stuff.
So let's just talk about what the ramifications of this are, because we're obviously early on in the Democratic primary type of season, and so they're going to be kind of throwing the red meat out to their own people, but you would expect that when it came time to, you know, once a candidate is selected, that they would be trying to tack more to the center to pull in more
right.
More Americans overall for the vote nationally. But there is obviously strategy here. I think we've been hearing reports about just how much the young people in this country are becoming more radical. And a lot of these views just sound wonderful to young people who maybe there are a lot of young people who are in college debt that they can't be forgiven for, that they're trapped under, and the idea of somebody coming along and bailing them out or, offering them all of these free things sounds really good. And they're not really thinking about what the economic ramifications of those policies would be. You wonder how many Americans there are who would not if the way that the Democratic Party is moving isn't actually going to have some kind of a backlash nationally.
Yeah, you do want to come in. Some of the opinion polls show that 57% of Democrats have a favorable view of socialism. So there's definitely a strong base within their party that they're catering to. Other polls also indicate that up to 51% of millennials, those under 34, have a favorable of socialism. So, I mean, it is a rising idea in the upcoming generation that they're trying to cater to. But on the other hand, you definitely saw this the last time the far left reared its head this radically back in the 60s and 70s, where at the time President Richard Nixon was talking about the vocal minority and the silent majority, where there was this perception that the nation was much more radically leftist than it was because of the, like, the Woodstock and the protest at the Democratic National Convention, right, and the hippies and all this just public facade. When it actually came down to the voting, they actually found out that there were a lot more, like, rural working class Americans who were watching the news and getting concerned about all these communist slogans being shouted on the news, and then they maybe weren't willing to get off work early and go protest someplace,
right.
but definitely voted. We saw that last election where, I mean, all the news agencies were saying, like, 95% chance Hillary Clinton's going to win.
Yep.
And then totally had this silent majority they didn't know about.
Yeah. Is it possible that we're going to see a similar scenario play out where people are just unwilling to put someone in office who's going to take the country in that radical of a direction? And then you wonder, with the way that they're positioning themselves, the kind of reaction that you might get. I mean, we're projecting pretty far out here, a couple of years before this we'd know exactly how this is going to play out. But you could foresee a scenario where you had if there were Donald Trump elected to a second term, the kind of unhinged reaction among the left, considering what they did with his first term, you just wonder how crazy it would get.
Right. And you definitely could easily see like a negative feedback loop where the Democratic Party gets more radical, and the fact that it gets more radical drives moderate Democrats either to the Republican Party or to an independent party or to just not voting at all. But then if those more moderate Democrats leave the party, the party becomes more radical because they're the only ones left. And so you kind of get this, like I said, negative feedback loop where the more radical it gets, the smaller it gets, the more radical it gets. And so, yeah, you end up with a silent majority that's conservative that can win elections. But at the same time, you've almost got like a Maoist, Marxist, Leninist style vanguard party that's much more willing to protest and resort to extreme measures,
yeah,
to fight back than a Democratic Party that was more Big Tent would be.
Well, yeah, we're already seeing that. There definitely is the very vocal segment within that party that is, using some pretty strong bully tactics to force their way into the public's consciousness and to move policy and to change legal structure and do what they can to remake society in their image. So it is interesting how you see this trend that seems to be driving a polarization within. In one sense, it's a move to the left, and to whatever degree individuals who are espousing these kinds of policies succeed politically, you end up with, broken economies within states, within counties, even nationally. You end up with in deeper debt. You end up with a weakened country and the ramifications of that, like we've been talking about, how that impacts America's military, our foreign installations. But then apart from that, there's also this polarization within the electorate, within the nation, as there's just a greater division and animosity between these camps that are kind of entrenching themselves behind the barbed wire. It's all very strongly, moving the country away from being a strong, unified nation.
Right, right. Yeah, because, it has been even a big change even since President Barack Obama left office, because President Barack Obama, he kind of had a skill. He had a skill of sounding less radical than he actually was. And so you'd say he espoused some of these same national health care policies that are regarded as like socialist policies, but he never publicly got up and praised socialism. He has a couple times since he's left office, and he did a couple times since before he was in office. But during his campaign, his rhetoric was much more moderate than it was. And so he got a lot of people to vote for him who may not have actually agreed fully with the direction he wanted to take the nation. He's almost pretending he's something he's not.
Anywhere that you would send people who wanted more information about this? Because we've obviously written quite a bit about just this trend toward embracing communism and the effect that that is going to have on the nation.
Right. Actually, two things come to mind. One is that, see, we have our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, has a book, America Under Attack, makes the same point I just mentioned about the Obama administration pretending it was something it's not in order to transform the nation, even comparing him to the ancient Seleucid king Antiochus, who also came to power by pretending he was something he was not in order to transform that nation. But then the second book, also by Mr. Flurry, Great Again, has a chapter in it called The Dangerous Roots of America's Turn Left. That one delves more into the root, just the roots of how America started becoming so left-wing, or especially the Democratic Party started becoming so left-wing. I mentioned the 1972 before. I think I mentioned 1972 before, and some of the protests with the new, what they call the New Left Movement. And this New Left Movement almost like hijacked the Democratic Party to where now, I mean, John F. Kennedy would be a Republican today. And that's partially because the Republicans have become more liberal themselves. But like I said, he totally wouldn't recognize this new party that this New Left Movement has hijacked. And moved continuously since the 70s further and further left. But that trend's really escalated since the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. And that book, Great Again, has a chapter that really explains the ideological roots behind why that is.
All right, very good. Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the radicalization of American politics. Those two books that he mentioned, those are available at thetrumpet.com under the Literature tab, America Under Attack and Great Again. You can go check those out. We appreciate very much your time, Andrew. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
As America shifts more socialist politically, a different political trend is playing out in Europe, the rise of new parties that are challenging the status quo in several countries. To talk about this, we have via Skype from our office in Britain, trumpet writer Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So tell us about this. You wrote about this in your trumpet brief last week and gave a very sweeping overview of how many different countries this is impacting. Maybe you can just start with that overview.
So this has been a trend we've really seen developing in Europe since, 2008, really, in the financial crisis, where just country after country, we've had upstart parties come along and throw the current political system into chaos. You've got the rise of the National Front in France. They've changed their name now, and you've got the protests that you see on the streets still going this weekend with the yellow vests causing disruption there. You've got the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany that is already just rocking German politics, where they're still even now struggling to work out how can we create stable coalitions that don't include this extremist group. You had Sweden spend about 3 months trying to get together a government, just managing a few weeks ago with the rise of the extreme parties there. You've had changes in government in Eastern Europe. You've got Viktor Orban in Hungary that has a very different view of the EU to the mainstream parties in Western Europe. The same for Poland. You've had these same kind of upstart parties. They took over in Greece. They've taken over in Italy, where you've got, again, some brand new parties. One of them didn't exist before the 2008 financial crisis. Another one was just a minor party. Now the two of them are ruling the country in coalition. So there are differences in each individual country. There are situations everywhere that are unique. But in country after country after country all across Europe, you've had this political earthquake and you've had new parties that have a radically different view of politics in general rise to the top.
So if we can draw some of the larger trends as far as what's driving this movement, you said each country has its own individual components or elements that are making this happen. But if you could characterize the broader issues that are causing such a reaction against status quo politics in Europe.
Well, this was part of the reason why I wrote this article, is a lot of people are looking at those parties and they're saying, they're calling them all Eurosceptic. And they're saying one of the big things that unite them is that they're all against Europe. When you take a closer look, though, you get a different picture. Mm. What unites them is they dislike a lot of specific things to do with Europe. But it's not necessarily – they're not European versions of UKIP, the UK Independence Party, that just fundamentally on an ideological level thinks there should not be a European Union. These other parties, they're different because they all disagree with what the EU is doing, but not necessarily its existence. So you look at the things that unite them. It's things like opposition to immigration.
Right.
So that's one of the big common ones. They don't like all of these migrants coming. They want to close the borders, especially Islam. Some of these parties, some are more extreme than others, but they generally believe that Islam does not belong in Europe. So they oppose things like the construction of minarets. They're in favor of bans for Islamic headgear. Some of them are trying to outlaw halal and kosher meat. All kind of things designed and aimed against Islam. They tend to be more conservative in society. So that society-wise, they talk much more about religion and generally will talk a bit more about family. That's a bit more varied. And when it comes to economics, they're generally all over the place. Uh-huh. You've got the National Front that's pretty far left, the Italian groups that are far left, the Alternative for Deutschland, that actually began as a much more kind of libertarian party of against bailouts for the rest of Europe. But it's that kind of it's opposition to this left-wing ideology that you see in Brussels is the main thing that keeps them together.
So I'd like to talk about this Politico piece and the conclusions that they drew in a minute. But just to talk about this aspect of religion and conservatism, mentioning this reaction against Islamic incursion, this is obviously something that really raises a red flag for anyone who knows the Bible's prophecies about what to expect from Europe in the time ahead. What's your sense of how broad, say, that kind of reaction is? We've seen a hardening of that position among many in Europe after there was quite a lot of effort among European politicians to show just how inclusive and how welcoming and tolerant they were of that. So this seems to be a pretty serious turn away from that position.
Yes, this is one of the big broad turns there. And I think if you look at Eastern Europe, I mean, we wrote on this, I think it was this time last year or maybe 2 years ago, where you've seen this wholesale shift already in Eastern Europe, where you've got leaders saying, Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, they're Christian countries, Muslim migrants are not welcome. Mm-hmm. And very explicitly come out and make those kind of statements. These upstart parties in Western Europe are very much on board with that. You look at the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, the ex-National Front that's now changed their name but still around in France. You know, they really do a lot to talk against Islam. I think it was Bikinis Not Burkas was one of the Alternative for Deutschland's posters last time there was an election, which I think shows their opposition quite well. It's an opposition to Islam and not necessarily the most Christian or moral response to that, but Islam is the big thing that they're against. But then more recently, where you had earlier this month, the leader, one of the big leaders, Matteo Salvini in Italy of the League Party, so one of the major upstart parties that's now part of the government in Italy, he traveled to Poland and he met with representatives from the Law and Justice Party, which is Poland's kind of right-wing party. They fall in this same kind of milieu of these upstart parties, even though they've been governing Poland for several years now. And they had their talk, and one of the headlines, the EU Observer's headline from that event, was "God and Russia dominate Salvini trip to Poland." And this was one of the big things they have in common. Russia was one of the big things they don't have in common. These countries have lots of different perspectives, but religion was one of the big things that united them. And Salvini, he said, "Europe must return to its identity, to its Judeo-Christian roots." And he said that these roots are rejected in Brussels in a crazy way where family values are rejected. Mm-hmm. He also said, "Poland and Italy will be the heroes of this new European spring, the rebirth of European values." And he referenced the Polish Pope, Pope John Paul II, and his call for a Europe of values, identities, countries, and nations, respect. So this is one of the biggest things that stretches across the party borders and unites this whole movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned just the fact that these parties are rejecting very specific things about the European Union. He mentioned just that anti-family bent that Brussels has. That's just one example of something very specific. It's not necessarily the European project as a whole, but it's elements of it that have proven to be very damaging overall. And that takes us to this Politico piece that you quoted from in this article. You were saying how the press is characterizing these political groups as Eurosceptic. Politico says it's much more than just like they want to kill the EU. That's not really a fair way of characterizing it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they hit the nail on the head with their piece. I'll read a few quotes from that. The title was "Thought Populists Want to Kill the EU. It's Worse Than That." But they said that, rather than seeking to dismantle the EU, such movements are looking at how it can be reshaped to make it capable of projecting strength internally and externally against ideological opponents or emerging geopolitical rivals. They said rather than dismantle the EU, far-right populists could help accelerate the militarization of the EU in order to project collective power into states along the EU's border in a quasi-imperial fashion. Mm-hmm. Which really is a striking quote, but that's exactly what you do see. You know, like Poland's Law and Justice Party are often called Eurosceptics, and they're kind of brought up as one of the big evidences of an Eastern European party that's against the European project. You look at what their leaders have actually said, though. Yes, they're very critical with Brussels. They're even involved in almost a lawsuit with Brussels where they're trying to Brussels opposes some of the way they're changing their judiciary. But they've also said that there should be a European army and a combined European nuclear force. Mm-hmm. Those are not Eurosceptic statements.
Right. And it seems exactly like they have this sense of the rising dangers that Europe faces, and they recognize this need to actually band together, even though they don't like the way that it's been implemented in a lot of ways in its present form. They recognize that it is as a united front, unified by, say, the Judeo-Christian heritage that Salvini was talking about, that it could actually be something that would be able to defend Europeans and that would be a formidable force. So seeing this trend playing out and knowing how this might impact politics on a European level, how much more are we going to see these parties actually having an impact in Brussels and you know, taking their seats in the European Parliament in the time ahead?
They're definitely going to become a lot more vocal and a lot more high profile. We've got the European Parliament coming up in May, and the polls are basically predicting another earthquake, that this will be a massive shift towards all of these different Eurosceptic, as they're called, but all of these fringe parties. According to a lot of the polls, the mainstream parties combined will probably get a majority, but that's not guaranteed. So that's not just So that's the left and the right mainstream parties combined. Mm. There is still, if these fringe parties do a little bit better than expected, they could actually be the majority in the European Parliament.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's a big shift for the character of Europe. Now, Europe isn't really a democratic institution. The European Parliament is the least powerful of all of its bodies, but it's the most high profile. There's still a lot that they would be able to do with that position. And then, the real power in Europe comes from the national leaders negotiating. And so as you see more and more of these national leaders going over to this view, you're just going to see that rise in power. And I think a lot of these parties, though, they wouldn't mind seeing Brussels get a whole lot less power and just working things out, though, in between different governments. And so that's another angle to watch. But these guys, it looks like they're going to be able to start putting forward their vision for Europe in a way that we've just never seen before.
So we need to keep our eyes on the European parliamentary elections in May. Put all of this in prophetic context for us. We talked about it a little bit, but this is something, really, this trend is something we've been watching for decades.
Right, exactly this trend, where we've been, you go back to what Herbert W. Armstrong was writing even before World War II, and he was saying, you're going to have a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire in Europe, and it's going to be a religious power. It's going to be led and influenced by the Catholic Church, and that was based on prophecies in Revelation 17 that describe this reoccurring empire led by a woman, which in biblical symbolism is a church. And now you see these parties coming along and talking about projecting the power beyond Europe's borders in a quasi-imperial fashion. Mm. Yeah, that's talking about resurrecting an empire. And they're talking about their Judeo-Christian heritage, about bringing the Catholic Church on and making it have a much more high-profile role in Europe. And that's a role the Catholic Church is very willing to play. You can go back, those comments, I think it was by around mid-2017 from Pope Francis, where he was saying Europe needs to be a federation. He's on board with this. He's not necessarily on board with the perspective on migration, but there are other senior figures within the Catholic Church that are. And you can really see these leaders helping to push Europe in that direction that we've known they would go in and for all these years.
It's extraordinary to see this playing out the way that it is. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this rise in fringe parties that are becoming more popular within Europe. He wrote about this in his trumpet brief last week. It's posted on thetrumpet.com. The article title is "The Rebel Alliance About to Take Down the EU Empire." Go check that out. Quite a trend, Richard, and we will definitely keep our eyes on what happens here in the coming months. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The African nation of Zimbabwe is in tumult right now as harsh economic conditions and bad government policy are provoking widespread protests among the public. The situation has some valuable lessons for us, as we will now hear in this report from Anthony Chibadadwe.
Protests in Zimbabwe are not like any that you tend to see in the Western world. They are never about statues, or about Supreme Court justices, or about gun control, or about a government's efforts to protect its borders, or about the precise location of underground oil pipelines. They are about survival. They are about the rule of law, human rights. They are about whether you have food on your family table tomorrow. They are about whether your bank will allow you to withdraw your own money from your account. They are about whether your employer, if you are fortunate enough to even have one, will afford to pay you this month. They are about getting by in a country with the most expensive fuel in the whole world. On January 13, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa announced that his government would hike the price of oil by about 150%, way beyond the means of the majority of Zimbabweans. He said that the hike in gas and diesel prices will curtail rampant illegal currency and fuel trading activities. But instead, it fueled protests across the nation because this scarce commodity determines the price of just about everything else. The inflation rate in Zimbabwe is the worst in the whole world, if we exclude Venezuela. Trade unions in the country called for a national strike, and they were backed up by the opposition party and a prominent religious leader. And inevitably, the strike and the protests turned ugly in some places. Civilians blocked roads, burned tires on the streets. Some started looting shops. And law enforcement authorities responded, but they responded disproportionately with brutal, overwhelming force. They blacked out the internet to limit online coordination of protests and quite possibly to also restrict the amount of real-time dissemination of information about the protests and the subsequent government crackdown. President Mnangagwa had to cut short his visit to the World Economic Forum in Davos to attend to the crises. According to human rights organizations, at least 12 people have been killed, hundreds have been injured from assaults, and 78 people incurred gunshot wounds. According to Amnesty International, more than 1,000 people, including minors, have been detained after being arrested on trumped-up charges or brought before courts in hearings that do not meet fair trial standards. Hundreds have been denied bail. And that includes trade union leaders who organized the strike and several opposition leaders. Amnesty International said that the onslaught of the security forces in Zimbabwe has seen people killed, arbitrarily arrested, abducted, reportedly raped, and jailed on suspicion of taking part in the protests. It also reported that children as young as 11 years old have been detained on frivolous charges. Now that's how the powers that be tend to deal with protests in Zimbabwe. Not with forced resignations of public officials, not with a compromise deal, not with the referendum, not with dialogue in parliament or in the Senate, but with brutal force, designed to ensure that no one else dares to challenge the government in any form in the future. On Monday, Sky News shared an eyewitness video report about exactly what that force looks like. A soldier, a policeman, and another security official in plain clothes were seen physically assaulting a helpless, handcuffed man. He was punched and slapped in the face several times, and in broad daylight. This made quite a lot of headlines, but that's primarily because a prominent foreign news organization managed to capture it on camera. Year after year, Zimbabweans hope that their fortunes will improve. And year after year, their hopes are dashed by a cruel dictatorship. Last year, Zimbabweans voted in their first ever elections that didn't have dictator Robert Mugabe on the ballot. But his comrades stole that election. And when the electorate protested against the results, the government dispatched the army to forcibly stop them, killing some of them, and again, in broad daylight. Pictures and videos of last year's crackdown are available for anyone to see on the internet. In one video from last year, captured in the central part of the capital, Harare, a soldier is seen charging forward, dropping to one knee and shooting at civilians as if he was on a battlefield. He stops shooting only after a fellow soldier charges at him and hits him in the back to get him to end the out-of-control madness. Back then, the government said it regretted such brutal actions. But barely a year later, the government's law enforcement arm is repeating the same brutal actions. The majority of Zimbabweans are friendly, peace-loving people. I've seen them, I've worked with them, I've lived with them. But after 39 years of independence from Britain, the majority of Zimbabweans are suffering at the hands of a brutal and incredibly corrupt regime. Why? And how can the suffering come to an end? When will Zimbabwe truly become free and independent? In the introduction to his book, Mystery of the Ages, Herbert W. Armstrong begins by discussing the many threats and evils facing all nations of this world. Then he makes this profound statement. The truth of God, if known and acted on, could save humanity from this threat and all its evils. Stop a moment. Think on this, he writes. So let's stop a moment and let's think on the truth of God. When white Europeans colonized Zimbabwe, they introduced the Christian religion, and today most Zimbabweans are Christians. That means that they have forsaken all their traditional religions and embraced the religion that they were taught by white Europeans. When the same white Europeans colonized Zimbabwe, they also introduced Western norms of governance. But today, most Zimbabwean leaders reject those Western norms of governance. That means that they have not forsaken some of their own personal or traditional forms of governance. The Plain Truth magazine, which is the predecessor of the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine, once interviewed Ian Smith, the Prime Minister of Zimbabwe before independence. He was of white European origin. Ian Smith was far from perfect, but during that interview, he made some comments that are proving to be more and more profound today. Talking about leadership, he said, "All we have done is insist on certain qualifications. We say, let merit be the criterion. We have always had standards which we believe people should achieve before they participate in government. After all, government is supposed to be responsible, and we believe that people should qualify and show a certain degree of responsibility, a certain degree of civilization, before we allow them to take part in government." Anyone can see that Zimbabwe's leaders today are deficient in the proper qualifications and the responsibility required to take part in government. Broadly speaking, every government of man lacks the precise qualifications required by God to take part in government. The white Europeans who colonized Zimbabwe also lacked those qualifications. But the reality is that the norms of governance they brought, even if they might have failed to implement them perfectly, had much stronger connections to the truth of God. Just like the Christian religion they brought, even if they might not have followed it perfectly, was much closer to the truth of God. Exactly how they gained some access to the truth of God is an incredible truth of its own, discussed in another book of Mr. Armstrong's, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. That book has a lot to do with Zimbabwe, because Zimbabwe once was a part of the British Commonwealth, a commonwealth or company of nations, which is actually prophesied in the Bible. Zimbabwe is currently facing a severe financial crisis, but it has tremendous wealth potential. And that potential is tied to the prophesied company of nations that it was a part of. Zimbabwe will very soon enjoy that wealth, but that will be after God is done preparing what the Bible calls the kingdom of God, which is the government of God, a government that will be established on earth soon. Its leaders will have qualified to serve people with godly responsibility. They will bring peace, freedom, and prosperity for every man, woman, and child. Thank God, His kingdom is almost here. It's Zimbabwe's only sure hope of escaping economic hardship and tyranny. Thank you.
time for today's last word.
It was an abnormally busy week. Late one afternoon, my wife was out running errands and she expressed concern that she'd be getting home late. I told her not to worry. I could use the extra time to finish some things at the office. I got home an hour later than usual and she still hadn't returned. The house was a wreck. This was really unusual, but all the activities, all the outside responsibilities had basically pulled my wife out of the house for several days. So I began cleaning. First, I did the dishes. She still didn't show up. So I tidied and wiped down the whole kitchen. Still no wife. Then I thought, wow, if I could get this whole house clean before she got home, she'd be shocked. I'd get some major brownie points. I dashed through the house, impassioned by this new ambition. I couldn't believe how much stuff had been left out, and an embarrassing amount of it was mine. Well, I always considered myself pretty good about picking up after myself, I thought. I made our bed, I picked up the floors, I neatened the kids' bedrooms. Finally, just as I was finishing putting fresh linens on the guest bed, in walked my wife with the kids. I greeted her as she entered, acted real nonchalant, but inside I quivered with anticipation at her realizing how good the house looked and lavishing thanks and praise on me. Well, she began to tell me stories about her afternoon, this deal, that person, and I feigned perfect attentiveness. Suddenly, she stopped short. "You cleaned the kitchen, didn't you?" I beamed. "That and a whole lot more," I thought. "Just wait till you see the rest of the house." But you know, she never really did notice the rest. She realized their bed had been made. She thanked me for that. Everything else apparently just looked normal. I didn't quite get the ticker tape parade I'd hoped for. Now, I wasn't bitter. I was just a little let down. We leaped in the car on a whim. We went out to a nice, relaxing family dinner. We moved on. But as I reflected on that experience, my mind drifted back to times, countless times, my wife had spent the entire day, not just a single frantic hour as I had, cleaning the house, wall to wall, baseboard to ceiling, and then greeting me coming home from work and waiting as I failed to notice anything she had done. And as I thought, I remembered times when she dropped hints. "I'm exhausted. I cleaned all day." And only then would I actually look around and acknowledge the work that she'd done. That evening, I could see. I saw, for one, that I needed to be more diligent about picking up after myself. But even more, I saw how important it is to notice and let her know that I notice. Personally, I might be inclined to think, well, that's her job, or, well, how can I notice? The place is always basically tidy. But that experience helped me to see more clearly from her perspective and to realize how nice it is just to receive some affirmation. In 1 Peter 3:7, God tells a husband, "Dwell with your wife according to knowledge." So it implies a link between that knowledge and, it says later in the verse, giving honor to your wife. How much knowledge do you have about what your wife's life is really like? What it's like, for example, to be around the children for hours on end, what it's like to see every mess as another job you have to do, or what it's like to handle the repetitive demands of making meals and cooking and cleaning. Do you express appreciation for her efforts to make your life beautiful and peaceful? Do you help her understand the importance of the work that she does? Dwelling according to knowledge means really seeking to understand her perspective. It means encouraging her to share her view and listening, coming to know her needs and wants so that you can factor those into the decisions that you need, and doing what's best for the whole family. James 1 verse 19 tells us to be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. And that takes work. It takes genuine effort to really understand your spouse's point of view. Men and women express themselves differently. Sometimes you have to consciously prevent emotions from clogging your ears and concentrate on what's actually behind the words that your wife is using. It's even important to dwell according to knowledge regarding your wife's feelings and emotions. Sometimes emotions are wrong. Sometimes they're silly. But just saying, "Well, that's just silly. You shouldn't think that," that doesn't actually help the situation. It's not dwelling according to knowledge. A husband should work to understand his wife's emotional needs. Ephesians 5 says a man's first priority is to love his wife. And a wife only knows she's loved if a man is expressing that love in words and deeds. Dwelling according to knowledge means embracing and fulfilling that God-given need for your love. Taking your wife for granted makes her feel starved of love. You express the appreciation. You notice when she's especially tired. You offer to help out. When she's sick, lighten her load. These are the kinds of gestures that not only give her the needed break that she needs from time to time, but they demonstrate that you love her. You care about how she's doing. You appreciate what she does. When a woman feels appreciated, she feels understood. She becomes less defensive. She becomes more cooperative. And two people who both feel understood are truly communicating. Do you understand your wife? That means being able to view the world through wife-colored glasses, so you can see the world as she does. Take the Apostle Peter's admonition to heart and dwell with her according to knowledge. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Anthony Chibadirwe. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Richard Needham. You don't marry one person, you marry three. The person you think they are, the person they are, and the person they're going to become as a result of being married to you. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.